morning, agus fáilte isteach. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Since 2014, I have been hosting this radio hour and am honoured to have the opportunity to bring to you interviews, talks and performances which speak to the Irish and Irish-American experience. As a historian trained in Ireland, Italy and the US, I have used interviews as a major component of my research, and I am always thrilled and honoured to use the medium of radio to share aspects of educational and ethnic interest. WNYE 91.5 FM is managed and operated by NYC Media, a part of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Broadcasting throughout the metropolitan area from the 4 Times Square Tower in Midtown Manhattan, it serves the public 24/7 with its schedule of programming. The programming aims to inform, educate, and reflect the diversity of interests that make up New York City's population. I hope you'll enjoy this week's This Irish American Life. On this week's show, folks, I'm really delighted to be introducing to you someone whose work I have followed for a number of years. His name is Ronan McGreevy, and I suppose you'd say his day job is with the Irish Times newspaper. But as you'll hear today, I am speaking to him this morning on This Irish American Life in the context of his new book, Great Hatred, The Assassination of Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson, MP. It's a timely conversation, in part because it's approximately 100 years ago, or just past the 100th anniversary of the death of this fascinating figure in Irish, British and British imperial history. I suppose it's also timely as well because, as you'll hear, one of Ronan's arguments through this book is that this assassination, which takes place at the end of June in 1922, reverberates in a very big way. It's not that Ronan is saying something new in that, but how he presents it in terms of a turning point in what evolves into the Civil War is quite timely, especially as we think about over the last few weeks. We've marked, for example, the 100th anniversary of the death of Michael Collins, which is part of this story in some way, shape or form. I had the pleasure actually at being at the 100th anniversary of the death of Collins, the annual commemoration at Béal na Blá in West Cork. My father actually comes from only 6 miles from there. So outside of party affiliation, it is a revered place in the locality because Collins was a local boy, had gone on to do massive things in terms of Irish history. I was there on the day of the official commemoration for the first time ever. The Fianna Fáil, in terms of political affiliation, the Fianna Fáil Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, TD, gave an oration, as well as the Fine Gael Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar. And if you're listening to this program, you probably know how impactful Civil War politics have been in Irish history, and that that's a big deal, that the two main parties who don't exactly owe their origins but kind of claim it in some ways, I suppose, the way politics evolved in that post-war period up until quite recently. It was a state commemoration. As a historian, it was very interesting to be there as someone who's familiar with the locality and knows some of the locals. It was also very interesting to be there. I was there with my dad, and that was lovely. It's been a fraught conversation around these commemorations at times. arguments made about which kinds of events are picked out, etc., etc. I suppose from a historian's perspective, it's always really, really interesting for us for when we have these moments that put a pause on things and cause us to reflect. Ronan McGreevy's book comes from a similar place in terms of saying, okay, 100 years out, revisiting the events around specifically the assassination of Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson. He was an important figure, and how Ronan contextualizes him in this great read is really, really worth engaging with, and I'm thoroughly happy that we're getting him onto this Irish American life to share with you all some of the nuggets that he has uncovered and how he has contextualized these events, given us pause for thought in terms of the complexities of how identities worked and arguably continue to work. But particularly at this period, he's a fascinating way in. And I just wanted to mention Collins there because this is all so timely and relevant. So I'm really looking forward to sharing this interview with you today on this Irish American life. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Always a pleasure to have you on board on a Saturday morning. I'm delighted to welcome to this Irish American life Ronan McGreevy. Ronan is an Irish Times journalist and videographer. And I'm speaking to Ronan today in the context of his new book, Great Hatred, The Assassination of Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson. His previous books include Wherever the Firing Line Extends, Ireland and the Western Front, and Centenary, Ireland Remembers 1916. In 2018, Ronan was made a Chevalier des Arts et des Lettres for his work on the First World War remembrance. Anyone who's a regular reader of the Irish Times, I'm sure, reads with interest his contributions. First of all, Ronan, welcome to this Irish American life. It's my first time having you on.
Thank you, Mary. It's an honour
and a pleasure. And congratulations on this great book. You must be delighted to be at this stage in the process, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And the book has been very well received, Miriam, I'm delighted to say. And yeah, I'm very happy. It's been I was very, very happy with the reaction to it so far. And thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. I'm really thrilled, and we'll get into this, Ronan. Not so much that it's a footnote in Irish history. I think you make that argument in the book that it's an aspect of Irish history that we perhaps didn't pay enough attention to historically. And Great Hatred is a great intervention into the historiography. We might talk a little bit about that. I'm going to assume, Ronan, that our listeners, we don't need to go down to ground zero in terms of starting the overview of Irish history as such. But on the 22nd of June 1922, with the assassination of this large personality in an Irish and / British context, it's referred to sometimes as Ireland's Sarajevo. Mm. For the benefit of our listeners today, Ronan, and for me indeed to have the pleasure to question you on this in this format, tell us a little bit about why this event and this assassination is a kind of trigger moment in terms of what's going on in a very tumultuous time we know in Irish history.
Thanks, Miriam. Well, just to paint the picture of where we're at in June 1922, we know that the Anglo-Irish Treaty was signed in December 1921 and that it split the Republican movement, split Sinn Féin between those who are pro-treaty and those who are anti-treaty. Many in the IRA went anti-treaty and in March 1922 refused to accept the provisional government as a lawful government of the state, and about 300 of them occupied the four courts in April 1922. They were in situ at that stage for over 2 months. The provisional government decided not to move them as it might trigger what would become the Civil War. There was also a general election on June the 16th, 1922, at which candidates who were pro-treaty won 78% of the vote and 22% went to the anti-treaty side. So on June the 22nd, 1922, the general election has just, the results have just come in. There's talk of the formation of a government. The question is whether De Valera's anti-treaty side should be in government or not. And that would be in defiance of the treaty, as the treaty states that everybody who is in government in Ireland has to sign an oath of allegiance to the king. So on the afternoon of the 22nd of June, 1922, Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson MP is unveiling a memorial at Liverpool Street Station to men who died in the First World War. He leaves the station and walks, gets a train back to his house at 36 Eaton Place in London, and he's assassinated on the doorstep by two members of the IRA, Reggie Dunn and Joseph O'Sullivan. This is a shocking event in British history. Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson was the head of the British Army during the last year of the First World War, and so he was the top military advisor to the British government. To cut a long story short, Dunn and O'Sullivan are quickly apprehended. British government blames the anti-treaty side and sends Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, sends an ultimatum to Michael Collins that evening, saying that if the provisional government does not deal with the anti-treaty side, then the British will do it for them. So straight away, the provisional government, as a result of this assassination, is left in a dilemma. Either it deals with the rebels in the forecourts or faces the prospect of reopening the war with Great Britain. So it reluctantly, and 6 days later, they decide to take the path of least resistance and open fire on the rebels in the forecourts, and that begins the civil war.
In that introduction, Ronan, thank you for that. It lays it out very well. I suppose what's shocking about it, and I want to ask you more about Dunn and O'Sullivan in a moment, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
I suppose what's one of the most shocking aspects of this assassination is, I suppose, where it takes place. And you've kind of contextualized the timing there. But it kind of takes place, you know, right at the heart of things. Could you elucidate that aspect of this assassination and maybe place the assassination of Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson in the context of assassinations as they were or were not occurring internationally for, you know, people like of this profile at the time?
There was a couple of reasons why this assassination is so shocking to the British public and to the British government. Britain is one of the few countries in the world that is immune, or few European countries that is more or less immune from a political assassination as a tool of governments and of opposition. The last assassination of a British politician in Great Britain was the Prime Minister Spencer Percival in 1812, and then of course you had the assassination of Lord Frederick Cavendish, the new Chief Secretary to Ireland, in 1886, the Phoenix Park murders. But those were regarded as kind of isolated incidents, which, you know, the exception proved the rule that Britain was a safe country for politicians. Now you can contrast that and with you know, the United States. There had already been three presidents assassinated by in the 19th century. And then you had, obviously, the Franz Ferdinand, who was assassinated at Sarajevo, and this was the triggering event for the First World War, but also the wife of the Austrian Emperor, a French president had been killed, Italian king, Portuguese king. And then in Germany, there was an orgy of assassination after the First World War. You had Matthias Erzberger, who was a very prominent politician in Germany, who was killed by sort of proto-Nazi sympathizers after the war. And then 2 days after Wilson's shooting, you had the assassination of Walter Rathenau, who was the German foreign minister. So, I mean, assassination was very, very common throughout Europe. And of course, obviously, there was also the assassination of the Russian Tsar in the 1860s. But not in Britain. And this was the thing, that Britain was, saw itself at least as a proper representative democracy where people resolve their differences by exclusively peaceful means, albeit, you know, Ireland being an exception in that case. But another reason why this death is so shocking to British society is because it comes 6 months after the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, and there's an assumption in the political classes in Britain, in the media classes and in the public in general, that Ireland has been dealt with as an issue. It's no longer an issue, and it's no longer a security issue for the UK. And then suddenly Wilson's death changes all of that.
I suppose, Ronan, one thing that maybe before we go any further is to give us a sense of who Wilson was. And he's a really interesting figure in terms of how he can position himself as being Irish, but very much part, you know, of a British sensibility in terms of empire. But maybe for some of our listeners, it may be surprising to hear that this is a man who speaks, I think, with an Irish accent, for example, Ronan. Tell us a little bit about his Irish connections and where he fits in that worldview of people of the era and that, you know, in the context of the Great War, et cetera, et cetera.
He was an Irishman and self-consciously one and was regarded as one by his peers. He was born in Corrygraig, County Longford in 1864. His family were Anglo-Irish going back to the Williamite Wars. His father owned a fairly substantial estate in Longford, which had been bought for him by Wilson's grandfather, about 1,200 acres in Corrygraig. Wilson would have had an upbringing that was typical of the Anglo-Irish class at the time. He was educated at home by French governesses, and as a result of that, he could speak French fluently, which had a massive bearing on the rest of his career. He went to Marlborough College, and his attempts to get into the British Army were very mixed. I mean, he failed several exams to get into the British Army, but eventually he got in by the back door, by the Longford Militia, and through the Royal Irish Regiment based in Clonmel, County Tipperary. He rises up the ranks of the British Army, both through undeniable ability and strategy and forward planning, but also, you know, he cultivated all the right people at the right time. By 1910, he's the director of military operations, and his first great success as a military commander is to prepare the British Expeditionary Force for deployment in the First World War. Wilson had been warned from the previous 5 years of the possibility of a war breaking out in Europe, and he had done all the logistical planning to ensure that the British Expeditionary Force, although it was small, it was about six divisions, was able to deploy on the left flank of the French in the opening phases of the war, and it helped to slow down the German assault. But at the same time, he had, in that year of 1914, he'd been involved with the Corrib Mutiny. This is this putative mutiny by Anglo-Irish officers who said that if the British government took military actions in Ulster, that they would refuse to obey commands. And Wilson was, even though it was almost treasonable what he did, he agitated against the sitting governments and the sitting government's policy of the day, and with the Conservative Party to undermine any attempts by the British government if they were to take action in Ulster. As a result of that, he was despised by the Prime Minister at the time, Herbert Asquith, and his promotion during the First World War was retarded as a result of that incident until Lloyd George took office in December 1916. Lloyd George liked the cut of Wilson's jib, eventually promoted him to become the Chief of the Imperial General Staff in February 1918. Wilson was one of the people who had advocated for a supreme Allied command, which involved the French, British and American forces all acting under one command and acting together in pushing the Germans back. This they did with the 100 Days Offensive in September 1918, which brought the war to an end in November, the armistice in November 1918. So Wilson is, according to many of his contemporaries at the time, one of the men who wins the war. But of course, you know, having won the war, he inherited a very bitter peace. The British Empire inherited a lot of mandates in the Middle East, in Palestine, and also in Mesopotamia, in the South Caucasus. And so he was confronted with a whole series of new problems. But the biggest problem for him on his watch in his last 3 years as chief of the Imperial General Staff was Ireland.
It's no understatement to say that, say, in that decade, or, you know, that, yeah, I suppose decade prior, he was not a fan of home rule as it was, you know, evolving as a potential outcome for Ireland prior to the war, et cetera, et cetera. Staunchly unionist in his yes. outlook.
Staunchly unionist would be an understatement. He was an extremist in the sense that he went further even than James Craig or Carson. Eventually, James Craig and Edward Carson accepted the reality that the rest of the, you know, as long as they could hold on to their Ulster readout, that the rest of Ireland could do whatever it wanted. But Wilson didn't even approve of that. He didn't approve of home rule in any guise, partially out of fear for his own community, the sort of Protestant Church of Ireland community in Ireland, but partially because he was a sort of ideological British imperialist who didn't believe that the native peoples of anywhere the British ruled were capable of ruling themselves.
Would he have then primarily after then when he's back from the war and holding that position, Ronan, would he have been primarily then based in London, would you say? Was it, you know, was that his kind of day-to-day, you know, where he would be?
So he would have been, he was the chief military advisor to the British cabinet. So he would have been based exclusively in London most of the time. Yeah. So, I mean, his whole worldview was based on that of a sort of British insider as opposed to an Irish person. And in fact, he did not approve of the British government's policies in Ireland at all, both for military reasons, but also for political reasons. He felt that there should be no parleying with the what he called Sinn Féin and the IRA at that time as being the murder gang. And he said that to Lloyd George once, and Lloyd George said, that's nonsense. You know, in politics, we have to do these things sometimes. He's very much an ideological British imperialist in that regard.
Tell us, if we can switch a little bit, Ronan, tell me about Reginald Dunne and Joseph O'Sullivan, the two men involved in his assassination. What did you reconstruct about these two individuals and how they found themselves on Eaton Place on June
22nd? There's been an awful lot of emphasis when you look at Irish historiography about the link with Irish America, etc. And that kind of tends to overshadow the fact that there's a huge Irish diaspora in Britain as well, and a very influential one, which were trying to bring about Irish independence as well, while at the same time sort of working and living in the belly of the beast, so to speak. What's interesting about Reginald Dunne and Joseph O'Sullivan, that they are London-born, so they're not Irish-born, and they actually really spend very little time in Ireland. Very sporadically have visited Ireland over the years. I could find no evidence other than as a child when his father was stationed as a British officer in the Curragh Barracks. I could find no evidence Reggie Dunne had spent any time in Ireland, really. Reggie Dunne is an only child. He's the son of a British Army bandmaster I couldn't trace his father's Irish roots, but they must have been back several generations. His mother's English born as well. His mother's family are from County Monaghan. Dunne is a Jesuit educated young man, deeply religious, intellectual, also a trained musician, who fights in the First World War with the Irish Guards, and after the First World War trains to become a teacher, where he falls in with the sort of Irish separatist movement through music and Cumann na Gaeilge. So Reggie Dunne is an only child. He's Jesuit educated at St. Ignatius College. One of the interesting things about him
is that Alfred Hitchcock is one of his contemporaries in that school. Joseph O'Sullivan is a more straightforward Irish upbringing. He's one of 11 children. His father and mother are both from County Cork. His father's from Bantry. They're from what they call themselves an old Fenian family. And yet, in the First World War, 6 of the 7 of Joe O'Sullivan's brothers, including himself, served in the First World War. And what's interesting about Joe O'Sullivan is that he lost a leg at Ypres in 1917. So he was a very unlikely assassin. He joined the IRA. Both of them joined the IRA in 1919 in London, and they were engaged before all of these acts. They were engaged in burning hayricks, the sabotaging railways, but mostly in smuggling guns. And they were also involved, and I think it's interesting to note that we really only know now the extent to which the Irish in London and the Irish in Britain in general were involved in smuggling guns to the IRA during the War of Independence. So Reggie Dunn became the officer commanding the London IRA in 1919. He was also sworn, and this is very important in the context of the shooting, he was sworn into the Irish Republican Brotherhood, the IRB, which had Michael Collins as its president. And also, so both of them are radicalized by during the War of Independence, and they're also involved, I think this is very important to state, in sort of putative plans to assassinate members of the British cabinet during the War of Independence, which fortunately never came to fruition. But they were well versed in plans to assassinate important personages in Britain, including Henry Wilson.
That's fascinating. You're so right, Ronan. That's, even though I'm very interested in Irish America and especially kind of Irish American nationalism, the point is well taken in terms of the London Irish community in that context as well, and the wider Irish community in Britain. And when you think about it, just how dangerous it was to be doing it, as you say, kind of that phrase, in the belly of the beast. It's a whole different context, and fascinating to learn a little bit about these two individuals. And they end up right being executed for this.
As I said, Joe O'Sullivan has lost a leg at Ypres, so he has a wooden leg. Reggie Dunn had also been injured during the First World War and had been invalided out. So, I mean, there were two of the most unlikely assassins that you would want to kill such an important person. So they were very quickly apprehended, having already also shot but not killed two policemen. They were put on trial and sentenced to death. And it's interesting that their trial only took a day, but it was on the same day that Earl Mountbatten got married, just down the road from the Old Bailey in Westminster Abbey. And as we know, you know, if you want to know the sort of the best analogy really for the shock that of the Wilson shooting is the Mountbatten assassination in 1979 by the Provisional IRA. They were sentenced to death. The IRA, Michael Collins sent over some of his most trustworthy men to try and rescue them from jail. Michael Collins had a good track record of rescuing people from British jails, including most famously in the De Valera in February 1919. But these were the most guarded prisoners in Britain at the time, the most notorious prisoners in Britain. And we now know from British military records that the British were on to to those who had gone over to try and rescue him. So when it was felt that it was impossible to rescue Ray Dunn and O'Sullivan from Wandsworth Prison, the officer commanding the IRA in London, who took over from O'Sullivan, a guy called Dennis Keller, hit upon a plan to actually kidnap the Prince of Wales and to hold him hostage and have the death sentence commuted to life imprisonment. It was a very harebrained scheme that didn't really work out, because they were going to kidnap the Prince of Wales at the Cowes Regatta, which he always attended, but this was the one year that he didn't attend, so it was a futile endeavour. So there really was nothing could be done to rescue these men, and so they were hanged on the 10th of August 1922 at Wandsworth Jail.
Ronan, would Wilson have been on that fateful day? Would he have been kind of nonchalantly moving around, or, you know what
absolutely,
I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this is after the this is after the signing of the treaty, and it's important to say, well, why is Wilson a target 6 months after the assassination? So, if I just might bring you up to date on what happened to him after his term as chief of the Imperial General Staff ends in February 1922, and he's immediately elected unopposed as an Ulster Unionist MP for North Down. He becomes the most vociferous and high-profile critic of the Anglo-Irish Treaty. And then in March 1922, he is made military advisor to, he's appointed as military advisor to the Northern Ireland government. This is in the midst of 2 years of what might be described as an embryonic troubles between 1920 and 1922, between Unionists, Loyalists and Republicans, between Republicans and the security forces in the North. There's almost 500 people killed in this period, and 1922 is the most violent month. So what happens is that Wilson is appointed as the military advisor to the Northern government, and he becomes associated with the worst excesses of the British state forces, the B Specials in particular, and the newly formed Royal Ulster Constabulary, along with some of the British Army units that are still based in the North. He's also going around Britain saying that there's no way the Irish can rule themselves, that the country is in a state of disorder, and that Britain will have to go in at some stage and reconquer Ireland and restore peace and good order. And this, obviously, these comments are incendiary, not just to the provisional Irish government, the Irish nationalism, but also to the British government, which has, you know, painfully negotiated this treaty settlement in the hope that it will end all the animosity between Ireland and Britain. So the irony is, at the time of his death, that Wilson was an enemy both to the Irish government and also to the British government.
Fascinating. Can I pivot a little bit with you, Ronan? My understanding is that your interest in this topic stemmed from whenever the firing line extends. Can you tell us, am I correct in that? And tell me a little bit about how, you know, that hook, I mean, it is, as you've talked about it, it's really fascinating story. Would you talk to me a little bit about your interest and, I suppose, where the great hatred, and I know, I realise you're not necessarily writing for other historians as such, but it's clearly very well researched and everything. How does this contribution to Wilson, to the historiography on Wilson, kind of fit into the general context of what had been written on him prior to Great Hatred?
My interest in the Wilson story is partially personal because I'm from Leitrim, so, which is neighbouring county. I went to school in Longford, St. Mel's College in Longford, so I know Longford, although I didn't really know the Wilson story when I was going to school there, and, you know, nobody talked about it. I also spent almost 9 years in London, so I'm fascinated by the idea of Irish identity, particularly among the second generation and third generation Irish, especially given that many people see a British and Irish identity as kind of conflicted, unlike, say, an Irish-American identity. Nobody sees a contradiction between being Irish and American. But, you know, what do you call people who are born and reared in Britain but identify as Irish? And that's still an issue today. In terms of my own personal interest, in terms of my previous book, Wherever the Firing Line Extends, the final chapter in my book is about a guy called Robert Armstrong, who served in the Irish Guards in the First World War. He might even have known Reggie Dunn, but he grew up on the Corrigrane estate. His father was the estate manager, and Robert Armstrong, after the war, became a gardener with the Imperial War Graves Commission, which is now the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, which looks after the graves of dead servicemen in France and Belgium and around the world, dead British servicemen. During the Second World War, the Imperial War Graves Commission staff are evacuated from at Dunkirk when the Germans overrun France and Belgium. But Robert Armstrong decides to stay because he's an Irish citizen rather than a British citizen. And as a result of that, he's tending to all those graves, but he also joined the French resistance to smuggle British airmen, Commonwealth airmen out of France and Belgium. He's caught by the Germans, sentenced to death. That sentence of death is commuted to life imprisonment, but he dies in a German prisoner of war camp. I mean, I remember writing the story at the time thinking, you just can't make this stuff up, you know. I mean, as a result of that story, you know, I thought to myself, okay, Curry Grain, yeah, that's the place that was burnt to the ground. That's where Wilson was from. So I thought that that story would be a very good follow-up to my previous book, because this is about the aftermath of the First World War. So, you know, they're all, Reggie Dunn and Joe Sullivan are veterans of the First World War, as is Wilson, although Wilson didn't actually serve at the front. So that's the context in which I wrote the story.
And how, I think Keith Jeffrey has been the main biographer,
yes,
of which,
right.
And how does Great Hatred kind of, you know, we all want to come away from one of these projects and we've added to the,
yes,
you know, the greater knowledge. Even I know this is a wonderful read, Ronan. I mean, I'm always jealous of my journalistic colleagues in the way in which they're able to make these really gripping, some of these historical stories. Tell me a little bit, though, about what you're kind of adding to the whole in that sense.
Well, if I don't mind saying so, I'm adding quite a lot, actually. I mean, Keith Jeffries was the last major biographer of Wilson in 2006. It was a very, very good book. Very well researched, very fair to Wilson, rescued his reputation from the disastrous consequences of Wilson's biography, which is published in 1927, based on his diaries, which were incredibly indiscreet and disparaging towards many of his colleagues, both in the British government and in the British Army, etc. So it was a very good book, but one, I suppose, weakness of the Jeffries book is that he really wasn't that interested in the circumstances behind the assassination of Henry Wilson. He went with the thesis argued by Peter Hart, not convincingly in my view, that Dunn and O'Sullivan had acted of their own accord in deciding to assassinate Wilson, as opposed to, you know, who gave them the order. There was a book on the assassination of Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson by Rex Taylor in 1961, and Taylor had written a very well-regarded biography of Michael Collins 3 or 4 years previously. Unfortunately, his book about the Wilson assassination wasn't very good. He came to the conclusion that Dunn and O'Sullivan had not chosen to assassinate Wilson. They were only there to barrack him at Eaton Place, but Joe O'Sullivan lost his nerve and decided to assassinate Shoot Wilson, and Reggie Dunn only had to go along with that. So it wasn't a great book, you know. But also, he, in fairness to Rex Taylor, he didn't have access to the documents I have access to. So, I mean, I had brought the story on by the fact that I've used the Bureau of Military History records from which were produced in 2003, but also, crucially, the Military Service Pension Archives records, which have been released over the last few years, which are in Aladdin's Cave of information about Irish history at that time, and have really vastly expanded our knowledge of what the Irish were up to in Great Britain, for starters. And, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Peaky Blinders. Peaky Blinders is set after the war, and the first two series are about a cache of guns that this Peaky Blinders gang has steals from the munitions works in Birmingham. The IRA are after them. Now, that was pure fiction when it was written back in 2015, but it actually turns out to be substantially true. We now know from the records that have been released as a result of the Military Service Pension Archives, the IRA were dealing with Jewish gangs, they were dealing with Italian gangs in Britain, they were dealing with gangs in Birmingham and Manchester. They burned Old Trafford, the home of Manchester United. They burned Main Road, the home of Manchester United. And just to give you some indication of, you know, how important these new sources are to Irish historiography, there was rumours over the last 100 years that there was supposed to have been a third man involved in the assassination who was going to be the driver and was going to take them away. We didn't know for certain who that third man was. Now we do know who it was, because Dennis Kelleher gave an account to the Military Service Pension Archives in 1953, which has only been made public now, that he was actually supposed to have been there on the day. He didn't turn up for reasons which he didn't explain, but it does go to, it does really expand our entire knowledge of this period. And I think I'm one of the very first books to have woven the narrative from these pension files into an actual book itself.
That's amazing. I'm so glad, Ronan. That's what I did want to ask you about, your sources. And as you point out, in terms of Taylor in particular, he wouldn't have had access to the same sources. Was Wilson someone, for example, did you have access to diaries or papers? Was he someone for whom you could reconstruct a little bit of his inner life from his own personal stuff as well?
That presented a difficulty to me, Miriam, because his diaries are actually in the Imperial War Museum in London. I didn't have access to them. But what I did have access to online and so on was the two-volume biography, which I mentioned before, written by Charles Caldwell, which had extensive access to his diaries. Also, he was a prolific writer, so I had an awful lot of, I also had a lot of source material, but there was less source material that I could get that hadn't been seen before, simply because of the pandemic, really. I just couldn't travel. But I did get to there's a couple of other archives that I was able to get access to, which really helped me, which was the files in the, again, I don't think Rex Taylor had access to these or Keith Jeffrey, but the files relating to the intelligence files relating to Reggie Dawn and Joe Sullivan, which are in Kew, in the British Archives and UK Archives in Kew, but also a sheaf of documents that was bought by the National Museum of Ireland in 2013, which they've never really opened, which was the papers of James Wyndham MacDonald, who was their solicitor, Reggie Dawn and Joe Sullivan's solicitor, which really contained, including the last letter that Joe Sullivan wrote, their last wills and testaments and all the rest of that kind of stuff. So, I mean, to me, it was a joy to write this book because as a writer, as well as a historian of some sort, I don't see the point in rewriting what other people have written. The whole point is to bring new information into the public domain. And thankfully, I was able to do that with this book.
Absolutely, Ronan, you're so right. Besides the fact that everyone comes with their particular kind of, what would you say, background or agenda in terms of what we're trying to expound in these writings. But no, you make a very good point. And I suppose I'm particularly happy to, through this great example, reiterate the way in which we may have overlooked historically. And, you know, on the American side, we pay a lot of attention to the Irish American community in terms of activism in the period. And mentioning that kind of diasporic component, Ronan, bring us to the United States again, because my understanding is that this assassination was front page, the headline news in the United States, right? This is on the international stage.
Yes.
It allows us to kind of connect or reconnect Ireland in that transatlantic triangulation of the United States, Ireland and Britain. Can you set that aspect of it up a little bit for the listeners and for me?
At the time of his death, as you alluded to before, Miriam, Ireland was dominating the foreign news coverage in the American newspapers at the time. Obviously, he had a huge diaspora. Also, I guess because, you know, Ireland was rebelling against Britain, which was also the old colonial power that ruled the United States or ruled America at the time. So we know that the Americans entered the First World War as a result of the Zimmermann Cable in April 1917. And obviously, prior to that, they had been a fairly isolationist position. But once they joined the war in 1918, right, there's a million men in France, a million Americans in France. I mean, you had this mass mobilization of the United States. John Pershing, while they're raw recruits at the beginning of the war, you know, the very fact that they're able to tip the scales, you know, in favor of the Allies. And the German Spring Offensive of 1918, in March 1918, is an attempt by the Germans to bring an end to the war before the Americans can really come in force to the Western Front. So Wilson has taken over as chief of the Imperial General Staff in February 1918, just as the Americans are arriving into Europe and are being deployed on the battlefields. And in March 1918, as a result of the German Spring Offensive, where the Allies come closest to losing the war, Wilson is agitating for a supreme Allied command under his friend Ferdinand Foch, who becomes the supreme Allied commander. The Allies are then, for the latter stages of the war, they're under one command. So if you can imagine from left to right, you have the British on the left, you have the French in the centre, and you have the Americans on the right. So the Americans start really bringing their material advantages to the fight in the spring or in the autumn of 1918. And then, of course, the 100 Days Offensive ends the war much faster than most people expected. Everybody expected that Germany would still be in the fight in 1919. So, you know, Armistice Day is a massive day in the United States. As we know, it's the first time, it's really the first time that America becomes the world power. We know that it had, you know, obviously become a very powerful nation in its own right. But after the First World War, it becomes top dog because the French and the British nations are exhausted as a result of the war. They start to lose their colonies and so on and so forth. Obviously, the Americans have a huge interest in what's going on in the First World War. And this is why, you know, Wilson is such a huge shooting, leaving out of the Irish context, right? Just as one of the main men who wins the First World War, he's assassinated on his doorstep. And, you know, you have the front pages of all those American newspapers. Some of them have it in their evening editions. But the following day, you know, it's the front page of the New York Times, it's the front page of the Washington Post, and so on and so forth. I mean, Wilson is a worldwide figure at this stage because of his involvement in the First World War, and also because he's there at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 as part of the British delegation. We know that Woodrow Wilson, obviously, who he disparagingly calls my American cousin, is trying to produce a new world order. This is the context in which the Wilson shooting is interesting in America, obviously because of the Irish angle, but also because of his involvement as one of the main people who brings about the Allied victory in the First World War.
That's so fascinating, Ronan. Thanks for going into that for me. I'm conscious of time, but I have a few more questions for you, if you don't mind, Ronan. Your book is so timely. It came out just around the centenary of this event. And of course, this time of year, we're thinking a lot about some of the other centenaries. And I suppose, could you thread in Michael Collins? We know with the benefit of hindsight, right, that only June, July, August, so two months later to the day, Collins himself is assassinated. Mm. Can you thread him in a little bit in the background of the lead up to Wilson's assassination and what you, if you did reconstruct kind of the aftermath of that up until Collins' assassination?
The critical question surrounding the Wilson shooting is who ordered it, if anybody ordered it. So I go into four arguments in the book. The first one was that Dunn and Sullivan acted of their own accord. I say that is not the case. Dunn and Sullivan were, there's no evidence that they ever acted beyond the instructions that they were given to by General Headquarters in Dublin, the IRA General Headquarters. They were seasoned soldiers at that stage. They had been under military command for 6 or 7 years, both of them. And all of their supporters in the UK said this is just nonsense, that there's no way that they would have acted of their own accord. The second proposition that was put forward, that was done by the anti-treaty side, this is what the British stated, but I've pointed out that there was no evidence for that whatsoever. And the actual anti-treaty side said that if they had done it, they would have admitted to it, but they didn't do it, I think it's fair to say. The third one... The third theory is that there had been an order to assassinate Wilson before the truce of July 1921, and that had never been rescinded. The first part of that proposition is correct. There had been an order to shoot Wilson before July 1921, but only in the context that other British establishment figures had been targeted. But all assassination orders had been rescinded as a result of the treaty. So that leaves only one viable proposition, that somebody ordered this shooting. it wasn't the IRA, despite what some people believe, because Richard Mulcahy, who was the head of the IRA at that time, never ordered that shooting, had no knowledge of it. Neither did the Irish government order the shooting. At the time, they were shocked and realised the counterproductive nature of it. So it leaves then one proposition: who ordered the shooting? And as I explained to you at the start, Miriam, you know, Reggie Dunn was sworn into the Irish Republican Brotherhood, which is a secret organisation which had Michael Collins as its president. And also, it's important to state that on the night before Wilson was assassinated, there was a meeting in Mooney's pub in Holborn in London, at which Sam Maguire was present, and Sam Maguire was the head of the IRB in London. Now, why would Michael Collins want Wilson assassinated? Well, let us count the reasons why. First of all, as I explained before, Wilson was blamed for the pogroms in the north, even though he had very little to do with them. Secondly, Wilson was agitating for the British to retake the Irish Free State. And thirdly, Collins had designs on ordering an offensive in the north once he had his National Army up and running. And he realised that Wilson was somebody who was a very potentially dangerous foe of Irish nationalism. Also, Collins despised Wilson personally. He described him as a violent orange partisan, somebody who wanted to re-establish sort of British hegemony in Ireland. And Collins made no secret about that. I mean, he made public his disparaging comments about it. So I don't have what you might call a smoking gun, but what I've done is I've put forward a case as strongly as I could in my belief that it was Collins ultimately who ordered the shooting. And as a result of that shooting, unfortunately, you know, it sets off the train of events that lead to the start of the Civil War on the 28th of June and to the death of Michael Collins at Bail na Blaw on the 22nd of August 1922.
So let me ask you, Ronan, that's wonderful that you kind of bring forward those four kind of possibilities, but if we lean into the one there, that last one, that Collins is responsible, do you think that he did not foresee what would happen in reaction to this assassination?
Yes, absolutely, he did. Yeah, he did not foresee what was going to happen as a result of that shooting. He thought he would get away with it, as he had got away with the Bloody Sunday shootings of 1920, as he had got away with the assassination of so many people, so many sort of British spies and informers during the War of Independence. He had anticipated that this would be a professionally done job, which it wasn't. He thought as well that there could be plausible deniability on the part of the Irish government, that they could claim they knew nothing about it, which is true. They didn't know anything about it. What Collins had miscalculated was the unhappiness of the British government with the toleration that had been shown to the anti-treaty side by the Provisional Irish Government, and also by the result of the election of June 1922, in which, you know, pro-treaty candidates won 4 out of the 5 votes. So the British government was saying, this situation can't go on. We can't have 2 governments effectively in Ireland. We can't allow the provisional government to continue extending and pretending that there's nothing, there's no issue here, that Rory O'Connor can continue to be in possession of the forecourts. So I think he had miscalculated from that point of view. So that's really it. So unfortunately, the events of the Wilson shooting would lead on to the Collins shooting. And I make the point in my book, and I put it out there as a proposition, because we can't prove it otherwise, to historians that the Wilson shooting changed the course of Irish history, because without the Wilson shooting, there wouldn't have been this civil war that happened. There might have been another civil war. There's no guarantee that would have happened. And if there hadn't been a civil war, there wouldn't have been the death of Collins, and the history of Ireland would have been different. So that's really the essence of my proposition as to the importance of this event in Irish history.
2 really quick ones before, and I'm sorry to take up so much of your time, but you're bringing out so many interesting topics and a point well taken in terms of the significance of this event. You know, when we're working on these projects, which primarily looking obviously at his assassination, but you have to get to know the man a little bit. Did you come to like him in any way, or is he someone you would have liked to have gone for a pint with, or no? How did you handle that kind of issue that we have as historians sometimes of sometimes maybe liking someone too much, which may not have been the case in this. How did you come to...
You're talking about Collins or Wilson here?
No, Wilson.
Oh, yeah. I found Wilson to be a fascinating character. He's been sort of a cartoon villain of Irish nationalism for the last 100 years for good reasons. But also, he was a fairly complex man. I mean, he didn't, for instance, support the sort of... He hated military and discipline, so he had no time for the black and tans or the auxiliaries, the manner in which they fought in Ireland. He didn't like what was happening in the north. He felt that the B-Specials was a sectarian force that would lead only to disaster for the north. You know, he believed in law and order, really. And, you know, he loved Ireland. I mean, he just had a different vision of Ireland. He believed that Ireland was better off within the British Empire, within the United Kingdom. He should have respected the viewpoints of people of Irish nationalism at the time, and he didn't. But, like, you have to say, he was well-loved by an awful lot of people. He would have been brilliant company, I'm sure. He was funny, he was mischievous, he was witty. When he died, there was genuine grief among a lot of the British political classes that they had lost somebody who was great fun to be around, had a great sense of humour, etc., etc. But you can't, on a personal level, I'm sure I would have found Wilson to have been a very interesting character. On a political level, I'm pretty sure that people wouldn't have agreed with him. But it's interesting how his reputation has been rehabilitated, because only last Sunday in Curry Grand, County Longford, I actually unveiled a plaque at Curry Grand House, at the location of Curry Grand House, stating that this is where Henry Wilson was born. Such an event, I think, would have been unthinkable a generation ago, but I think we've become much more generous-minded in our commemorations now. I was very, very happy to do that.
I saw that they were, himself and his, they didn't have children, right, Ronan? So how, but you've engaged with some of the descendants, and yes, I imagine they've welcomed an intervention like this in terms
Absolutely. And the Wilson family, I mean, not just Henry Wilson, but his family is well-liked in Longford, and they were not by any means rack-renting landlords or anything like that. I met Robert Wilson Wright, who is his closest surviving relative, although he's quite distant. He's a spitting image of him. And I also have been in contact with another Henry Wilson, who's a former British Army, who's the editor of Pen and Sword, which is a big publishing house of military titles in the UK. To be honest with you, they are quite proud of the Wilson family and their achievements in Ireland in general, as there's quite a few significant Wilsons come out of that family in Ireland, but not of Henry himself. I mean, they regarded his views in Ireland as being quite backward, even by the standards of the time. He's part of our history and part of our culture, and, you know, as much as General Sean McKeown was, who was his neighbour in Longford. So I was really delighted to be able to do that.
Well, it's a great read, and I'm so delighted, Ronan, and I thank you for your generosity of time and spirit in sharing the insights of the background of this great book, Great Hatred, The Assassination of Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson, published by Faber, available in the United States this autumn now, Ronan, right, so people can pick it up on the US side. I hope that you continue to uncover and share with us in your wonderful way these insights into Irish history. And indeed, the wonderful thing about Wilson is how he puts an Irish story in the context of that international and British history, or an imperial history, in an interesting way that for which we're grateful to learn more about. Thank you so much, Ronan, and a real pleasure to have you on today.
Thank you so much, Miriam, for having me. Really appreciate it.
This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records.